person on the roster is John Rubenstein from Toronto, and he'll be talking about all of his assigned topics in optimizing image acquisition. John.
Will you step in? Thanks, Bob. So I'm delighted to be here. This is always a very exciting meeting, and this is a very exciting time in the field of cryo-EM, as you all know. And I hope that excitement is able to keep you awake for the next hour and 15 minutes as I talk about the mathematics behind detectors. I know that everyone likes to think about math at 9 in the morning. So what I want to do in lecture today is I want to first talk about how you optimize images. I'm not going to deal with this in depth because not too much has changed with how we optimize images since the introduction of direct detectors. But I do want to make a comparison between an F20 microscope and a Titan Krios microscope. My purpose in that comparison is not to compare these two particular instruments, but to compare what we might call high-end instruments and intermediate-range instruments. I'll talk about a mysterious optimization that seems to be specific for imaging with a direct detector, and then I'll start with some mathematics for direct detectors. We'll talk about exposure weighting. I'll introduce the problem of aligning frames, and then give a little refresher on some really basic math that will be remedial for some of you who think about this stuff every day, and more of a challenge for some of you who haven't thought about this stuff before. So for that, I'll talk about padding and truncating Fourier space, the Fourier shift theorem, and cross-correlation functions. Then I'll move on to how we use this mathematics to do things like downsampling images. I'll give a little introduction to matrix multiplication, and then I'll introduce how we align whole frames with the motion core algorithm that came out of Yifan Cheng's lab. I'll talk about aligning how we shift frames using these Fourier theorems, and then the challenge of aligning individual particles and a method that we've developed in my group to do that. So the first thing I want to deal with is getting good images. And as I mentioned, not too much has changed since we've introduced direct electron detectors. And 2 years ago, I gave a lecture on this topic here at NREM. And one of the great things about this NREM meeting is you can always go back and listen to lectures. I've gone back and listened to quite a few lectures over the years, sometimes multiple times. But to illustrate what might have changed a little bit, or what we need to consider now that we're working in this new regime of high-resolution structures with direct detectors, I want to do this comparison of how we would use a Technite F20 as an intermediate-range microscope and a Titan Krios microscope. So one of the most important differences between a Titan microscope and a Technite microscope is the existence of a third condenser lens. If you want to achieve parallel illumination with a Technite F20, you need to set up the parallel illumination intentionally. You need to choose a combination of condenser aperture and condenser two aperture and condenser two lens setting so that you get that parallel illumination. You can do that in a variety of ways, in microprobe mode and nanoprobe mode, and this lecture has, that topic's been covered in the past, and also the FEI engineer who gave a presentation yesterday covered other ways of doing that, and Bob has an excellent paper on setting up parallel illumination. With the Titan Krios, you just have parallel illumination. That third condenser lens always gives you parallel illumination. Anybody can do it. You don't have to think about it. So that's awfully convenient, but you can get parallel illumination with the Technite microscopes. With a Technite microscope, we also have to avoid lens hysteresis. If you drop down in magnification, you'll be turning lenses on and off. If you drop down and go up in magnification, you'll be turning them off and on. And that turning off and on of lenses can cause hysteresis in the lenses so that their strength changes over time, and that causes distortions in your images. We can avoid that with a Technite microscope by using an overfocused diffraction pattern for our low magnification mode. That gives you a low magnification image without turning the lenses on and off or causing major changes in lens current, and that's an extremely useful technique for getting to high resolution to avoid distortions. With the Titan Krios, again, you don't have to think about it. The microscope has constant power lenses, so regardless of what magnification you go to, you will not induce lens hysteresis. So that's convenient, but you can achieve it with a Technite microscope. The two different microscopes have two very different stages. The Titan Krios has a cryo autoloader, and the Technite F20 has a side entry cryo holder. And when we're working with CCDs and film, that was an extremely important difference, because if your stage is drifting during the time you acquire the image, you'll have a blurred image with a side entry cryo holder, where the cryo autoloader is a much more stable stage. So during the acquisition of the image, the specimen will not move as much. That should lead to better images. With the invention of direct detectors, we're now typically recording movies, and you can computationally correct for that stage drift. You might still do better with a stage that doesn't drift, but you can deal with that stage drift with a side entry holder. So You don't have to think about it. You have to computationally solve the problem. There is another very real difference between the two microscopes, that the Titan Creos operates at 300 kV and the Tecni at 200 kV. That means that the curvature of the Ewald sphere will be a bigger problem for the Tecni microscope than it is for the Titan microscope. The deflection of the beam by charging of the specimen will be a bigger problem for the Tecni microscope than it is for the Creos microscope. And there's another difference, and I'm blanking on what it is. But that, we've got beam charging, we've got Ewald sphere curvature, and multiple scattering would be a little bit of a difference also. So there should be a better performance from 300 kV microscope, but I suspect that there are only a handful of people in this room whose projects will really benefit from the difference between 300 and 200 kV. And I'll return to that a little bit later on. There's another very important difference to consider, especially when you think about the fact that many projects will not benefit from that change of microscope, and that is the difference in price between the microscopes. So if we imagine that, and these are very approximate numbers, the Titan Creos is around a $5 million microscope, and a Tecni F20 is a $2 million microscope, then you have a $3 million difference in price. I personally have trouble picturing numbers bigger than five. So in order to illustrate what that difference in five means, I want to take you back to a rainy Sunday afternoon in Cambridge when I was a graduate student in 2001. And I was spending the day in the lab working with Richard Henderson doing experiments. And during the course of doing experiments, Richard not only helped me freeze and look at EM grids, but he also fixed the cupboard below the glow discharge device in the third floor EM specimen preparation room. He fixed the paper towel dispenser in the men's room, and we cleared out the structural studies fridge of spoiled milk. When I suggested to Richard that perhaps that wasn't a good use of the director's time, director of the Laboratory of Molecular Biology, he responded that he thinks his time is worth about £20 an hour. Now, that was 2001, and it's 2014 now. There's been inflation, so that'd be £29 an hour this year. I looked that up on the internet. And converting from US dollars to British pounds, that's around $49 an hour. So this $3 million difference in price corresponds to 62,000 hours of Richard's time. And if Richard were to work 35 hours a week, as the law says that one should, of course, I don't think Richard has ever worked as little as 35 hours in a week, then that would be 34 years of Richard Henderson working in the lab. So when you consider that perhaps your project won't benefit from switching to a Titan Creos, you have to make the decision whether you really want to spend the time, whether you really want to spend that money buying a microscope, or whether you'd be better off with Richard Henderson in your lab for the next 34 years. And that's actually an important question, because if you decide that you want to buy a Titan Creos, you're going to be spending your time trying to figure out how to get money for it and how to support it. And to quote my esteemed colleague Lewis Kay, when asked by an administrator when we were trying to put an application together for some high-end instruments, including NMR spectrometers, what will these instruments discover? Lewis replied, machines don't make discoveries, people do. And a perfect segue for that is a discovery made by something that was noticed by Jinhua Zhao in my lab, simply by looking carefully at his data. And we benefited from the fact that we're collaborating with Nico's lab, and we're in constant communication with Alexei Ru. And Alexei realized that the problem that Jinhua was noticing probably is something that Tim Grant had worked out in their lab. And in order to explain that problem, I wanted to show you one of these beautiful thallus chloride nanocrystals. This is the kind of thing that material scientists work on. It's a nanocrystal, a nice little dot, and you can probably see the lines, the crystalline lines, that correspond to an interatomic spacing of 3.82 angstroms. If you calculate the power spectrum from one of these nanocrystals, you see diffraction spots. So here's the power spectrum. You see these two spots that were produced by those interatomic lines going this way. If you average the power spectra from a large population of these nanocrystals, you get this average power spectrum. And this should be a circle with the distance between the origin and the diffraction spot being inversely proportional to the interatomic spacing of that thallus chloride crystal. But unfortunately, it's not a circle. If you overlay a perfect circle, you can see that this circle diverges from the diffraction pattern here and here. We're looking at an ellipse. So Samir Benlekber, a postdoc in my lab, collected all the particle images that went into this diffraction pattern, and I very carefully went through at extremely high magnification, marking out where I thought this circle was, or this ellipse was. And if you plot the distance from the origin versus where you are in the circle, you don't get a straight line, as you would expect for a true circle. You get this. So we're clearly looking at an ellipse. That tells us that the magnification of the microscope is not the same in the x direction as it is in the y direction. we actually have approximately a 2% error. And a 2% error, if you're looking at a 100 angstrom particle, is 2 angstroms. If it's a 200 angstrom particle, it's 4 angstroms. So that can start to be significant. So what we then did is wrote some computer programs that can take in Fourier space this diffraction pattern and contract it. I did this by sync function interpolation. The effect of contracting the diffraction pattern or contracting the Fourier transform is to stretch the image. And then when you calculate the average of the power spectra from all of these images, now you have something that's actually a circle. Another effect of this anisotropic magnification is that, an important realization is this anisotropic magnification, that is that it seems to be a bigger problem at low magnification settings than at high magnification settings. So if you set up your microscope, you focus at high magnification, and you adjust the astigmatism of the microscope, and then drop down to low magnification, take a picture, you'll have at high magnification, you'll make the tone rings nice and round, but at low magnification, they're distorted, so the tone rings will not appear round anymore. So there'll be an artificial appearance of astigmatism due to that anisotropic magnification. And that's because when we calculate our contrast transfer function parameters, the way we specify that is by a defocus in one axis of the tone rings, perpendicular to a defocus in another axis of the tone rings, where let's say this is the longest axis and this is the shortest axis, and we specify the angle of astigmatism as the angle that this defocus 1 makes with the x-axis of the plot. So this will look like objective lens astigmatism, even though it's anisotropic magnification. And this is actually how Jinhua noticed that we have a problem, because just by being careful and looking at his data thoroughly, he plotted the defocus 1 parameters versus the defocus 2 parameters of a large data set he'd collected. This is not sampled for every image. And he saw that there's a systematic deviation from the line. You expect that if you, on average, don't produce any astigmatism, on average, the points of defocus 1 versus defocus 2 will lie in the line. But you can see that they actually lie on average above the line. Lying below the line is exactly the same as lying above the line, because you can just switch your definition of what's defocus 1 and what's defocus 2, and you switch this ratio. Jinhua actually wrote a program that will correct the CTF parameters after we've stretched the images, and after you apply those corrections, now your defocus parameters fall exactly where they should. So this is weird. This is a problem that many of you know Nico and his group, Tim in particular, have noticed in their Titan microscopes, not a problem specific to Tech9 microscopes. But we don't know how many other people in the world have this problem. And I think it's actually much more common than people think. Thankfully, Yifan Cheng was very generous and with his data and posted his TRIP V1 dataset online. And Jinhua took that dataset and plotted defocus 1 versus defocus 2. And we could see this deviation. And of course, we immediately told Yifan that we'd noticed that. And I think he's working on making sure that they do a correction. So I think that if you haven't already, if you're using a microscope, and this seems to be specific to the K2 detector, where people must go to lower magnification than they used to use in order to acquire images, I think it would not be surprising if many people find that they have this problem. And I understand from Nico that FEI says they have a fix, but it has not been implemented on any microscopes yet, so we're all implementing it computationally. So check that if you haven't already. Okay, so I want to get onto the mathematics for direct detectors. And the really exciting thing about direct detectors, besides the fact that they seem to have a higher detective quantum efficiency than a piece of film or a CCD, is that you can acquire movies. Because of the CMOS nature of the sensor, you can acquire an exposure series. And this is an image. It's not a particularly good image. There are yeast VATPase particles in there. They're quite nicely crowded in. And this is the average of 30 frames acquired with a total exposure of 30 electrons per square angstrom. And the individual frames can be acquired with as little as 1 electron per square angstrom or even less. Now, quite a few years ago, Lindsay Baker in my lab and I sat down, and we realized that when we were taking pictures on film, we didn't know what the right electron exposure to use was. We knew that if you used a really large electron exposure, you'd cook your specimen, and if you used no electron exposure, you'd have no signal or image, but we didn't know what the optimum was between those two extremes. And for that, we turned to some papers from the late 70s by Bob Glaser. And Bob showed, making a few assumptions about the behavior of the detectors, that as you acquire an image, the signal-to-noise ratio will go up as you use more electrons, and then that information at a specific resolution is gone in the image, in the specimen. So every additional electron just adds noise to your image. And Lindsay made some very careful measurements using catalase thin crystals, and this was done on film. We didn't have a direct detector at the time. And we measured the critical exposures and the optimal exposures for different spatial frequencies. And even though we didn't have a direct detector at the time, we were already thinking that with direct detectors, we should be able to acquire movies. So we made the statement here that if we could acquire a movie, we'd be able to use the high exposure frames for getting the low resolution information, and the low exposure frames for getting the high resolution information. And several people have taken this idea and gone much further with it. David Beisler here at Scripps has collected data sets using different exposure series. His maps were, at the time, at lower resolution. And he did see that there was a slight benefit from limiting the exposure at higher resolution. Shores has done a really elegant implementation. I like this approach very much, where for each image in the exposure series, you come up with a B factor to account for that degradation of the information in the later frames. Wachu's group has just got the paper out where they actually used our measurements from 2010, but they made them more conservative. And they also saw that that benefited their map. I think, actually, Tim Grant has a poster, which everyone should look at, where that was probably not the right thing to do. And Tim has shown that by measuring these critical exposures with single particles, our measurements that were made with 2D crystals were unnecessarily conservative for the low-resolution information. So you should all have a look at Tim's poster, and I think those values that Tim measures will be extremely useful for optimizing exposure weighting, signal-to-noise, in different frames. Although, Tim, you should probably chat with Bob about the assumptions of the detectors that are used in that signal-to-noise curve. So the other thing, of course, that we could do with these movies is we can align the frames. And the problem that occurs while acquiring movies is that the specimen can move during the exposure. And it can move for one of two reasons. The stage could be drifting, so the whole specimen could be moving across the field of view in the time that it takes to acquire a movie. And this is a particularly pronounced problem if you're using a counting detector like the K2 Summit, because you'll have to take movies that are at least 5 seconds long. And in fact, the movies that we acquire in our lab are 15 seconds long with a side entry cryo holder. And a typical cryo holder stage drift might be as much as 1 angstrom per second. So with 5 angstroms, you could have 5 angstroms of drift during your exposure. And that could really blur out the information in the images. The other type of problem that could occur is beam-induced motion. And it turns out this might be even more significant, and it's much harder to deal with, because it may cause a shift of the entire specimen, the entire field of view, during the exposure. But it may not be uniform. It can cause a distortion of the specimen. Right now, we're just thinking of that as shifting the molecules in different amounts, but really it's causing a three-dimensional distortion. And there isn't much that has been done for dealing with the whole 3D distortion, although Nico has looked at that a little bit. So this is a much harder problem to solve. Now, I've actually been told by quite a few people that this is an interesting problem and this is a boring problem, because all you need to do to solve this problem is buy a Titan Krios. Now, the people who have made that suggestion are usually the ones who have not had to come up with the money for a Titan Krios themselves. So I've found problems very interesting that cost far less than $3 million to solve, but it is true that you can't avoid it by having a Titan Krios. So in order to talk about how we deal with the beam-induced motion and the stage drift, I want to introduce a couple of very basic topics in mathematics. This is a wave. It's a one-dimensional wave. And to describe this wave, we need to know a couple of things about it. We need to know its amplitude. We need to know its wavelength. And you'll probably realize that this wave is not the same as this wave. And the reason why those two waves are not the same is they have a different phase. They have a different displacement from the origin, some arbitrary point. We're shifting the two different waves. So in order to describe a one-dimensional wave, we need to know those things. A very convenient way of representing a wave is as a vector, where the length of the vector corresponds, and these are waves if we know the wavelength. The length of the vector corresponds to the amplitude. The angle the vector makes with this axis over here corresponds to the phase, and that's really all you need to know if you already know the wavelength. So traditionally, in representing these vectors that correspond to waves, we've represented them as vectors on the complex plane, where these are imaginary numbers and these are real numbers. And when I first encountered this as an undergraduate student, I said, come on, do you really need to bring imaginary numbers into this? This could be a vector on any plane. It does turn out that that's quite a useful way of representing vectors. So the imaginary numbers are the square root of -1, and now each vector on this complex plane is represented by how far it moves along the real numbers how far it moves along the imaginary numbers. So we represent it as this Fourier component that has the form a plus bi. It's a complex number. And it turns out that a lot of the math of dealing with how you add waves and combine waves is much easier if you do treat them as complex numbers. So what's the first thing we want to do? We want to talk about Fourier transforms. So here is a function, some arbitrary function. And you can imagine, actually, this was proven, and it was a very important thing to demonstrate by Jean-Baptiste Fourier in the 1700s, that you can take any function and describe it by a sum of an appropriate series of waves. So you need to know what the wavelengths are for these waves, you need to know what the amplitudes are for those waves, and you need to know what the phases are for those waves. So when we describe this function as a series of sums of waves, that's taking a Fourier transform. So with the three waves that I'm telling you are components of this function, we would just represent them as how much of the wave there is, at what frequency, and we also need these quantities to tell us what the phase is for each wave. So we can't just write down the magnitude of each wave. We need to describe each wave by a complex number. So each one of these waves is described by a Fourier component of the form A plus BI, and the Fourier transform is simply a list of those waves that have contributed to your function. As we shift a wave, all we're doing is changing the phase. So here's a wave, and we just shift it a little bit to the left. Here's the vector that represents it. We've caused a phase change. We've rotated that vector. We shifted a little bit further to the left, and we've rotated a little bit more, and we shifted much more to the left, and we've rotated that vector even more. So what happens to functions when we move them? What happens to their Fourier transforms? Well, here's a function, and we shift it to the left. There it is, shifted to the left. All the waves that contributed to that function, they also must be shifted to the left. And shifting a wave just causes a phase change. So this wave has undergone a phase change, that wave has undergone a phase change, and that wave has undergone a phase change. But they've all undergone a different phase change. This one's undergone a fraction of a wavelength, this one's undergone about a wavelength and a half, and this one's undergone a couple of wavelengths of phase change. So that's our first Fourier theorem. And that is that shifting a function in real space causes a phase change to the Fourier components that make up that function in Fourier space. Here's a very simple line image. It's a one-dimensional function sampled every angstrom, and at every position along this one-dimensional image, there's some density. So this is a very, very simple image. The Fourier transform of an image of n pixels will be a function that has n over 2 plus 1 complex pixels, or n over 2 plus 1 Fourier components, and that's a standard discrete Fourier transform. A relationship that every electron microscopist should commit to memory, and I don't say this lightly because I've committed almost nothing to memory, is that the resolution of each spatial frequency encoded by these Fourier components is equal to the pixel size times the extent of the Fourier transform, so here 8 pixels, divided by how far that pixel is from the origin. So for this pixel right at the origin of the Fourier transform, it encodes a wave that is 1 angstrom times 8, that's 8 pixel Fourier transform, divided by 0. It's right at the origin. So this pixel encodes a Fourier component of undefined wavelength. The next complex Fourier term encodes a wave that is 1 angstrom times 8 divided by 1, or that's the 8 angstrom resolution information. And this is why when you plot a Fourier shell correlation, the bins at the bottom have this sort of distribution of numbers. You'll calculate the bins in your Fourier shell correlation based on this relationship. Your size of your Fourier transform, your pixel spacing, and how far from the origin you're on the Fourier transform. Okay, so this is a relationship I think everybody ought to remember. So if we take a Fourier transform of n pixels, and now it's 8 pixels, we expect the Fourier transform to have 5 complex Fourier components, so n over 2 plus 1. And now, what happens if we remove a couple of the Fourier components? So we just take these two highest resolution Fourier components, we just lop them off. Now we have a Fourier transform that corresponds to an image of 4 pixels. And you'll notice that the spatial frequency here is twice the sampling. And the spatial frequency here is now lower resolution. So the sampling has gone down for an image of the same size. So the inverse Fourier transform has 4 pixels, and each pixel now corresponds to 2 angstroms. So that's another important Fourier relationship. The truncation in Fourier space corresponds to downsampling in real space. And this is an extremely powerful thing that we'll use when dealing with images. What if we did the converse? We take our real space image of 8 pixels, we calculate its Fourier transform, and then we just make up Fourier components. We make them 0, and we just add them on to the end. So we pad our Fourier transform. So we just added a bunch of zeros, and now this Fourier transform corresponds to an image of 16 pixels. The highest spatial frequency is 1 angstrom, whereas before it was 2 angstroms, so we now know that we've got finer sampling in our image. So by padding our Fourier transform with zeros, and then back transforming, we now come up with a 16-pixel image where the sampling is finer. We've done a very efficient interpolation of our images. We've supersampled our images simply by padding the Fourier transform. So that's our next Fourier relationship to remember. The padding in Fourier space leads to interpolation in real space. But of course, we're not dealing with one-dimensional images. We're dealing with two-dimensional images. So here's a two-dimensional image. Again, it's a nice simple image, 6 pixels by 6 pixels. And again, each pixel in the image has some value. And we're used to seeing those values represented as grayscale values in our images. Our Fourier transform has an origin over here, and then has the higher frequencies that way, higher frequencies and Y that way. And this seems like a bit of a ripoff, because we know that the numbers in our Fourier transforms are complex numbers. So they form A plus BI, whereas the numbers in our real space image were just simple real numbers. So it looks like we have to store a lot more information than the computer if we're going to represent a two-dimensional image as one of these Fourier transforms. But it turns out it's not as bad as it looks. So each image in the Fourier transform is the form A plus BI, so you might think you're storing more values, that you're storing the A's and the B's, not just the A's. But if this is a real image, if all the pixels have real values, then there's a relationship that tells us that the Fourier transform of a real image has a property of being Hermitian. And a Hermitian Fourier transform has this property where if you know the pixel value over here, or the Fourier component over here, the Fourier component on the opposite side of the origin is simply the complex conjugate of that pixel value. So this Fourier component just has the opposite sign. It has the same values for A and B, but you reverse the sign between the real part and the imaginary part. So right away we know we don't need to worry about things on this side because we can figure them out from things on this side. It also turns out that the values at the Nyquist, at the highest frequency of the Fourier transform, aren't complex, they're real. And the values at the positive Nyquist are actually the same as the values at the negative Nyquist. So we don't have to write down these values either. So when we store the Fourier transform of a real image, we only need to worry about this section of it. All of these we can figure out, and these we can figure out because they're the same as those. So it's still a little bit less efficient than storing a real image, but almost not at all. So to summarize the properties, the Fourier transform of real functions, and images are real functions, are Hermitian, so that for every point A plus BI, there's a corresponding point A minus BI on the opposite side of the origin. For an N by N image, our Fourier transform is then N over 2 plus 1 by N. So this is 6 by 6, N over 2 plus 1 is 4, so that's 4 by 6. So that's the size of the Fourier transform we're going to store. And each Fourier component of this image is, again, a complex number. And each one now encodes not a single one-dimensional sine wave, but a two-dimensional sine wave. So there's a Fourier component over here, and it encodes this sine wave. It encodes the amplitude, so the magnitude of this vector tells you the amplitude of this sine wave. The position of this Fourier component tells you what the frequency of that sine wave is. And the phase of this Fourier component tells you the phase of that wave. So something further along the axis over here corresponds to a higher frequency sine wave, and a Fourier component over here, the position is telling us the direction of the sine wave. So the way that our two-dimensional Fourier transform describes the 3D image is we add up all the sine waves encoded by all of these complex pixels, and that will give us the image that gave rise to this Fourier transform. This column is symmetric with these values?
Yeah.
That could very well be.
Sure.
Yep, okay. Absolutely. So that saves us a few numbers we don't need to write down.
But in your computer, it will be
stored. Okay.
Convenient.
Right, so I guess that's a... Yeah. And it's also true, the origin is real. It's not complex. And it corresponds to the sum of the squares of the pixel intensity values, I think. Or is it just the sum of the pixel intensity? Just the sum of the pixel values. Yes, I've indicated that. Yeah. Oh, but I didn't indicate it there. Good point. Right. Okay, so now we want to talk about, we talked about shifting one-dimensional line images. What happens when you shift two-dimensional images? So again, we've got these Fourier components that are complex numbers. We can represent them as vectors, and the consequence of shifting the image that gave rise to this Fourier transform is simply to cause a phase change in each one of these Fourier components. And the amount of phase change is given here. So the shifted Fourier component is going to be equal to the unshifted Fourier component times this factor of cosine phi plus I sine phi, where phi is given by how far is that pixel from the origin in x, how far is that pixel from the origin in y, how big was the shift you applied in x, how big was the shift you applied in y, and then this factor over here, 2 pi over n, where n is the size of the Fourier transform. So by shifting a real space image, we cause a phase change in each one of these Fourier components. Let's use that. So Nico measured with his postdoc, whose first name I can't recall at the moment.
Rachel,
thank you. He measured the detective quantum efficiency for a series of detectors in different conditions. And one thing that they noticed was that the detective quantum efficiency for the Gitan K2 summit in super resolution mode, in green, was better at high resolution than the detective quantum efficiency of the same camera in counting mode. And that's an interesting phenomenon. There might be some interesting causes for that. But what that tells you is that if you want the highest detective quantum efficiency at the highest resolutions that you're looking for, you might want to acquire your images in super resolution mode. But acquiring super resolution mode has some undesired consequences of your 4K by 4K detector is now, you're recording pixels of 8K by 8K. The detective quantum efficiency of those super resolution pixels is not very good at all. You probably don't want to use them. And you also don't want to store all those values. So what you probably want to do with this detector is acquire your images in super resolution mode and then downsample. So you could imagine that you have an image over here, and the easiest way to downsample, the naive way to downsample, is take this image of this 12 by 12, and you want it to be 6 by 6, so you just draw another grid on it. Say, okay, I'm just going to average the values in here, and average the values in here, and average the values in here, and that's, I think, would be actually, now I'm confused. So it may actually still be a good thing to do, but it won't be fast. You don't think it would be a good thing to do. So it should be better to do it in Fourier space, but if the reason is aliasing, then it's not necessarily a bad thing to do. But anyway, I shouldn't have made it that complicated there. So this is one way to do it, and it's probably not the best way to do it. The better way to do it is to calculate the Fourier transform of your image, and then just extract the portion of that Fourier transform that corresponds to the lower resolution image. So you pull out the portion that you're interested in and put that into a new array in your computer program and then back transform, and now you've gone to this downsampled image. So that's using our cropping theorem, and it tells us that all we need to do to compress this image is Fourier transform, take out the region that corresponds to the information we're interested in, and the back transform to get the compressed image. And that's exactly what a lot of programs will do. We've been using Alexei Ru's program to do that for our images. Another very handy property of Fourier transforms is that we can use them to very efficiently calculate cross-correlation functions. So if we have two images, and we calculate the Fourier transform of the first one, and we calculate the Fourier transform of the second one, and for every value in the second one, we take the complex conjugate, so we take all the Fourier components of the form A plus BI, and we just switch the signs, so we make them A minus BI, and then we multiply those two Fourier transforms together, we get another Fourier transform, and then we back transform. Seems like magic, but that will give us a cross-correlation function. And that cross-correlation function tells us the maximum and the position of that cross-correlation function, tells us how much we should shift image number 2 with respect to image number 1 to get the maximal agreement. And we use this in many of the programs for image analysis. So that is exactly what's used by the motion core algorithm from Yifan Cheng's group. It's a very elegant algorithm. In order to explain a little bit more fully, I need to introduce a little bit more math. So if you'll bear with me, this is some matrix multiplication. So matrices can be written down in an equation. Here's a 3x3 matrix versus a 1x3 matrix. So that gives the answer of multiplying these two is another 1x3 matrix. Matrices, you can't invert, you can't just switch the order in which you multiply them. So A times B is not necessarily B times A. And a matrix multiplication equation is simply a way of writing down a bunch of old-fashioned equations. So what this matrix multiplication equation tells us is that A11 times X plus A12 times Y plus A13 times Z is equal to C1. And it also tells us that A21 times X plus A22 times Y plus A23 times Z is equal to C2. And A31 times X plus A32 times Y times A33 times Z is equal to C3. So this matrix equation is simply a way of recording a bunch of equations. And remember, the problem that we're trying to solve is how do you align frames? You've got these frames where the specimen drifted throughout your movie, and you want to bring the features in those movies back into register so that when you average the frames, you can extract the high-resolution information coherently. So just for convenience, we'll define that this first frame is unshifted. This, it's not probably what you do when you use the program, but just for convenience, that's what we'll say here. This is the origin. This is the frame that did not move. And all the other ones moved some amount, and we need to figure out how much they moved. Well, we can calculate cross-correlation functions between the different frames of the movie. So we can calculate the cross-correlation function, and the cross-correlation function will tell us how much we need to shift each frame in X and in Y. So it's going to give us a vector, an X shift and a Y shift, for how to bring that frame back into register with the first frame, the unshifted frame. We can calculate an awful lot of these cross-correlation functions. So we can calculate 6 unique vectors to describe the motion of those 4 frames. We can calculate the cross-correlation function between frame 1 and frame 2, frame 1 and frame 3, frame 1 and frame 4, frame 2 and frame 3, frame 2 and, frame 4, and frame 3 and frame 4. So it turns out that for a movie of Z frames, you can calculate Z over 2 times Z minus 1 cross-correlation functions. That means if you have a 30-frame movie, as we acquire in my group, you can calculate 435 cross-correlation functions. And this is really nice, because this means when we try to figure out the motion, and as you can see, you only need to say, how does it move from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3, and 3 to 4, this is going to be a very highly overdetermined problem. Okay, so let's put that in matrix form. These T values, and this is for our 4-frame movie, are the true translations that we want to know. What was the translation when we moved from frame 1 to 2? What was the translation when we moved from frame 2 to 3? And what was the translation when we moved from frame 3 to 4? These M values are what we measured with our cross-correlation functions. We measured between 1 and 2, 1 and 3, 1 and 4, 2 and 3, 2 and 4, and 3 and 4. So this M12 should just be this. So the first row of our matrix will be 1, 0, 0. Well, so correlation, the measured value 1 to 2 should be that, plus 0 times that, plus 0 times that. And in matrix form, we'd write that down as 1, 0, 0. So 1 times that, plus 0 times that, plus 0 times that should be what we measured. When we measure the motion between frames 1 and 3, it should be this plus this. And that would be written down as, so it's this plus this times 0 times that. That's written down as this row. So 1 times the motion from frames 1 to 2, plus 1 times the motion from frames 2 to 3, plus 0 times the motion from frame 3 to 4. The motion from frame 1 to 4 should be the motion from 1 to 2, plus the motion from 2 to 3, plus the motion from 3 to 4, and the row in our matrix is now this. So that times that, plus that times that, plus that times that, is that. And we can fill in the rest of the matrix. So now we have this system of equations, and luckily, this is the sort of thing that people who study linear algebra have thought about for, well, the sort of problem they solved an extremely long time ago. And there are extremely efficient ways of finding out what are the values of this T12, T23, and T34 that will best explain the data, that will be the best fit for the data, give us the least squares fit of the data. So I think that Yifan's postdoc actually did this manually. When I implemented this algorithm on our own program, I simply called, there's a linear algebra pack, or if you're writing programs in Python, they can find least squares fitting solutions. I probably also use linear algebra pack. So you can very efficiently calculate these values. And it's a very nicely overdetermined problem, so you can get extremely good values for the translation from 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and 3 to 4. But they didn't stop there. They improved the algorithm in several other ways. So the first thing they did was, they said, when you calculate a cross-correlation function, you find some peak, maybe you can find that peak with sub-pixel accuracy. So the program, the motion core program, will take out the cross-correlation peak, calculate its Fourier transform, and then pad it. And then it'll calculate the back transform, and when you back transform this padded Fourier transform of the cross-correlation peak, you don't just get a bigger version, you get an interpolated version. And that interpolated version could more accurately tell you what the cross-correlation, where the true location of the cross-correlation peak is between those two images. They have another improvement that they implemented, and that was after they realized that the shifts between adjacent frames are often very hard to measure because there's an artificial peak right at the origin and there's not much of a shift between frame 1 and 2 or frame 17 and 18. So they just went through and they removed the measured peaks that are from adjacent frames. So you could set this value yourself, I believe, in their implementation. In our program, you can just set which... By the way, our program is like EFON's program, but about 100 times slower because it's not on GPUs. So there's absolutely no reason to use it. So you can just decide how many of these equations you want to ignore because they are the peaks are not reliable. You just cross out those equations in your matrices, and then you redetermine those true translations. That should give you an improved measure of the trajectory of your movie. Now, another thing that you can do after you've estimated values for the translations between frames is you can calculate what those measured values should be. So I told you that the measured value should, over here, should be just that value. If it's far off, you can say, okay, that wasn't a reliable measurement, so I'm going to ignore it. So let's say that you recalculate what you should have measured from frame 2 to 3, and you know that that should be... equal to translation from 2 to 3, you can say, I don't trust that value, so I'm just going to cross that out because the residual was too big. There's a number that you couldn't measure accurately. And that should also improve your measurements. Okay, so now you've measured how much each frame shifts, and now you need to apply those shifts. Let's say you measured that the shift from frame 1 to 2 was minus 1.2 pixels in the x direction and plus 2.3 pixels in the y direction, and so on. You measure this table of shifts. If those were integer pixel shifts, it'd be trivial to just say, okay, they're shifting by a set integer pixel amount. We're just going to read off in the new image what the value was in the old image at that corresponding position. But unfortunately, these numbers I've indicated here are not integer pixel shifts. So if you then get these values and try to interpolate what the values of the new image should be, it gets kind of messy. You have to come up with some interpolation of saying, okay, the value of this square should be somehow the average of these two weighted towards this one, and it gets really painful to calculate the interpolated images in real space. Not very elegant. But it's very straightforward to calculate the Fourier transform of your image. Remember that the phase change of each Fourier component is given by this expression over here, where this is a complex number. You're just going to take the original number and multiply it by this term, cos phi plus I sine phi. Phi is given by, for this pixel, the shift value, which you're reading over here, minus 1.2. So it's going to be minus 1.2. How far this pixel is from x in the... How far this pixel is from the origin in the x direction? It's 3 from the origin in the x direction. This pixel is 4 from the origin in the y direction, and the y shift is 2.3. There are these normalizing factors of 2 pi over 12 because it's a 12-pixel image. And then you just apply those phase shifts and back transform, and now you have all those shifted images with the shifts measured from the motion core algorithm.
Just to prove that I'm saying that.
Zero coefficient multiplied by a complex number. So what? So Powell, for it's left to the reader. So what is the product of a real number? So you're saying it's going to be a complex number. Go back where? Yeah. Right. Real, and now it won't be real if you multiply by a complex number. Phi will be zero, exactly. Yeah, thank you. So my students will know I cannot do arithmetic while standing in front of people. It's actually a crippling disability. So Powell will trip me up at some point. Okay. Are there any questions from students? Because this is a natural breakpoint. The phase shift is zero, so you get the same number back. Oh, so Powell's question is the value at the origin is real. And I'm saying you take this number, so the real number is just has a real part, the imaginary part is zero. And then when you multiply this real number by this term, which has a real part and an imaginary part, Powell's saying that a real number times a complex number is a complex number. So now the origin should be complex. But the distance from the origin, the distance from the origin to the origin is zero. So these coefficients over here will be zero, the phase change will be zero, and the sine of zero is zero, so the imaginary part disappears, Powell.
Well, not that would be true. The shift would be bigger if
No, because the distance of the origin to the origin is always zero. Okay. But actually, this is a natural breakpoint in thinking. So are there any questions from students? Right, no, that's right over here.
Yeah.
Yes, so those are zero at the origin. Okay. Are there questions from students? Because I'm going to, yeah. Sorry, the...
This one.
Right.
So, in principle, if you're looking for the least square sense solution for this system, isn't it just the pseudo-inverse of the matrix which is full with ones and zeros?
Pardon me? Is it?
The least square optimization for this problem, isn't it just the pseudo-inverse of
this
matrix?
Yes, it's related to pseudo-inverse. I haven't worked through the linear algebra myself. I know there's a mathematician in the audience somewhere. So what I do is I give the whole system to a subroutine that does the least squares fit, but it does involve the pseudo-inverse.
So, but since the matrix is already predetermined, it will always look like that, am I correct?
This
one,
left-hand
zero, zero,
side
one,
will.
One, it will always look like that.
The left-hand side will, the right-hand side won't.
No, the left-hand side.
Yes.
So in principle, the pseudo-inverse can be calculated, of this form can be calculated in advance.
I suppose that's right.
Okay.
I have not thought about this.
Line you want to take out.
True.
So, you have to design because that's when some give you much bigger error than the other. So you cannot predetermine that, you know, just plug in the number.
So although I will say, Ifan, that in our experience, this algorithm, the basic algorithm, is so robust that removing the outliers often makes little difference. It's so highly overdetermined. Are there any other questions from students? Okay, so I'm going to ask you to focus.
So, can I pretend to be a student? Question.
No.
The M12 value and so on the right-hand side in that thing, are those, no, not this one, the back on the matrix, yeah.
I'm sorry, in the matrix.
Yeah, these ones. So the right-hand column of M12, M13, are those the peak values in this cross-correlation function only? Okay,
yes.
So you don't consider any of, if there's other peaks that are almost as high or something.
What I'm sure Ifan's done is just pick the maximum. So, of course, this is a little simplification because there's both an X shift and a Y shift. So these are vectors, in fact, but they're just the position of the maximum in the cross-correlation function. So this is interesting. It means that people using the program who are mathematicians or do a lot of math haven't looked at it that carefully yet. Okay. Is everyone happy? Good. So I'm going to need you to focus a little bit more. So now we want to look at how do you align individual particles. And this is an algorithm that we've developed in my group. I've worked with an extremely talented postdoctoral fellow. It was a great time because he's a much, much better mathematician than I am. And he was basically my advisor during this work. And I was writing code and chatting with him, and he's giving me great suggestions of things to try, and it was a really enjoyable thing to do. So we're dealing with a movie of Z frames, whether Z is 30 frames or 4 frames or 2 frames, and there are J Fourier components in the image. This image, or the Fourier transform of the image, this Fourier transform of the first frame has a complex number at every position, and that's a Fourier component. It has the form A plus BI. If we shift this frame, we cause a phase change in the Fourier component. And the phase change, okay, sorry, that's right. I just changed this. Right, so we have all these Fourier components. If we want to calculate the correlation between two Fourier transforms, that's just a slight modification of the cross-correlation function I told you earlier. So this is correlation in Fourier space. It's not normalized, but this is just to make things simpler and easier to follow. So the correlation between two Fourier transforms, and this is exactly what you do when you calculate a Fourier shell correlation, doing the correlation between Fourier transforms, not cross-correlation between images, the correlation between two Fourier transforms is the sum of the product in a pairwise fashion of the pairs of Fourier components. So we multiply corresponding Fourier components from image 1 and image 2, but we take the complex conjugate of the Fourier component from image 2. So for each Fourier component in image 2, we invert the sign of the imaginary part. And the cross-correlation of these two Fourier transforms is going to be summed for each of the pairs of Fourier components. And we only need the real part of that. Because remember, in this way of representing a Fourier transform, for every Fourier component here, there's another one on the other side that we're not writing down that has that's the complex conjugate. So when we do this pairwise multiplication, for every term A1 plus B1i times A2 minus B2i, minus because of the complex conjugate, we can expand that out. And we have this imaginary part over here. But remember, for every pair, there's a corresponding pair that we're not showing down here. And those will have the opposite signs for their imaginary parts. So this will be A1 minus B1i times A2 plus B2i. And when we multiply that out and add them together, you can see the imaginary parts are exactly the same but have the opposite sign. So when we add those together, the imaginary parts disappear. So when we calculate the correlation between two Fourier transforms, we can just take the real part of the sum of the product of the Fourier components where we're taking the complex conjugate of the second Fourier component. So what we want to do in our approach is we want to find what we call an objective function. And that's a function that when we find its best value, say its maximum value, we're maximizing the sum of the correlation of each shifted frame with the sum of the shifted frames. So we've got a series of Fourier transforms. We're going to allow there to be different shifts. We're going to measure the correlation of each shifted frame with the sum of the shifted frame. And we want to find a function that when we add up those correlations is at a maximum. Or, exactly equivalently, we want to find a function that when we add up those correlations is at a minimum. Because it turns out that optimization is an extremely big field in computer science. And the convention is that you minimize functions to optimize them. So there are lots of algorithms for minimizing objective functions. Is everyone with me? Sorry, I heard a no. Okay, so what we're trying to do is, I'm not going to guess yet what the shifts are for the frames, but I am going to say that when the correlation of the shifted frames with the sum of the shifted frames is at a maximum, we probably have good shifts for the frames. Okay. Right. So, here is our movie of Z Fourier transforms. And I told you that each Fourier component of the form A plus BI is written there. But if we're now talking about the shifted Fourier components, we also have to multiply by this term, cos phi plus I sine phi, where phi depends on how much of a shift you've applied. And I'm still not telling you what the shifts are and where that pixel is. We can represent that phase shift term by just this S sub JZ, which is simply this expression over here. So now the Fourier components are going to be FJZ, and Z tells you which slice, which frame you're working on. J tells you which Fourier component you're working on. The shifted Fourier components are FJZ times SJZ, and we still don't know what the shifts are. If we add up all of those frames, we know that the Fourier transform of a sum is the sum of the Fourier transforms. So if we have the Fourier transform, the sum, each pixel is simply going to be the sum of the corresponding pixels in all the shifted frames. So we just sum up over all of the Z frames. So if we've got 30 frames in our movie, we're going to sum these shifted Fourier components between 1 and 30. So that's going to be the value of the Fourier component in the sum of the shifted frames. I still haven't told you what those shifted frames are. But now we can say that our objective function is going to be the correlation, and this is exactly the same as the correlation I showed you a slide ago. So this is the sum of the shifted frames Fourier component times one of the shifted frames Fourier components. We're going to do that for all the Fourier components in that particular shifted frame, and then we're going to add on top of that all of the shifted frames. So when this function is, I put a negative sign, so when this function is minimized, we're going to have the maximal correlation between each shifted frame and the sum of the shifted frames. So the function that we're trying to optimize has two variables for each frame. So if we've got a 30-frame movie, we now have 60 functions. It's a function of 60 dimensions. And just showing you a trace through one dimension, we're now trying to find the minimum. And if we can find that minimum, I'm hypothesizing that that minimum will give us, when we read out where we are for the x shift and the y shift for each frame, That will give us the best values for the x-shift and y-shift of each frame. And this is really where I was at this point when I started talking to Marcus. And I went to Mark, and we were chatting about something. We were doing a few things together. And I said, it's too bad I can't calculate the first derivative of these functions, because that would be extremely useful. Marcus looked at me blankly and said, yes, you can. And he also said, oh, you should always check that the function minus the function plus a really small amount over a really small amount is approximately equal to the derivative, because you may remember from high school calculus that differentiation is really easy, but it turns out when you're writing programs that differentiate complicated functions, it's really easy to make a mistake. So these were two of the first of many very important contributions. And the reason why we're interested in that first derivative is that if we have this function, at every combination of x shift and y shift for each frame, we can evaluate the function is, but now that we know the derivative, so there's the function at that combination of parameters, the derivative tells you the slope of the function. And there are extremely powerful algorithms for finding optimum functions if you can measure what the slope is for every variable. What you do not do is simply, as the textbooks call it, greedily follow the slope of greatest descent. But there are algorithms, and you may have heard some of his names, conjugate gradients, and on Marcus's suggestion, we implement the Broyden-Fletcher-Goldfarb-Shannon algorithm, the limited memory version, which is where the program gets named from. And one of my students looked at it and said, why did your program have LMB in the title? And I hadn't noticed that. So we can calculate the derivatives, they're messy. And then for each particle, and now you can do this with an entire frame, you can do this with a small box, these are the trajectories for individual particles of, these are boxes of 320 by 320 pixels, anywhere in the movie. If you look at particles over here, you can see they're all moving in sort of a similar direction, but they're noisy. And if you look at particles in the bottom right corner, they're also moving in similar directions, but they're also noisy. So we can improve this algorithm, because we know a couple of things about the motions of particles. For example, we know that particles probably aren't moving like this. They probably have a somewhat smooth trajectory as they are irradiated. So this is an unlikely trajectory if we look at the x-shift as a function of frame. So we can penalize trajectories that we don't like. We can say if we know that the motion from at frame or the position at frame z is over here, but the positions at frame z minus 1 and z minus 2 are over here, based on these positions, I would have expected the basic assumption is that the motion, the acceleration, the velocity doesn't change. So I would have expected that frame z would be found over here, but it's found over there. And that's unlikely because it suggests a change in direction. The slope that we would have expected is x at z1 minus x at z2, just extending this line. And the slope that we observe is x at z minus x at z minus 1. So that deviation is unlikely. It's not necessarily wrong, but it deviates from the basic assumption that the particles are going to be moving smoothly. So we can come up with a penalty function where we simply take the difference between the expected slope's over here, and the observed slope. We'd square it so that we remove the sign, and we multiply by some factor, lambda. If we don't have any strong preconceived notion about trajectories, we set lambda to 0. We can do whatever we want, there's no penalty. If we say we know this is moving as a straight line, we make lambda a very large number, and that will strongly penalize any deviation from this expected trajectory. Yes?
Can you explain the assumption that the particles are moving smoothly? Why do you...
Seems right. Yes. Right. So it's not a very good assumption. Yeah. Absolutely. But we do know that we don't expect them to be going forward, backward, forward, backward, forward, backward. We could expect them to move and then slow down and turn around, or maybe even do that a couple of times. And we can control how strongly we penalize those sorts of changes by this, the strength of this lambda factor. Sorry, Lizzie. Yes. So it's not really an assumption, it's just to use a Bayesian term, it's a prior. So if you are doing something weird, you have to convince me that it's real. We're not going to penalize it that strongly, so don't worry. But on the other hand, you could make the assumption, and at some level it's probably a good enough assumption, that the particles are all moving in straight lines. And that has worked tremendously well in Schrödinger's reliant particle polishing approach. So we could, by setting this to be an extremely large number, make it a straight line. So you just have to decide, do you believe this, which I don't, or do you want to really allow for the possibility of particles doing that, which I don't really care to do that much. I'd rather they look reasonable. But I admit, it is a fairly subjective decision. So our objective function of the smooth, are there any other questions? Our objective function of the smooth trajectory now becomes the original objective function plus a penalty function. And the derivative of the sum is equal to the sum of derivatives. So our derivative of the smooth function is now the derivative of the original objective function plus the derivative of the penalty. That's a bit messy, but really not that bad. So we just add that derivative of the penalty function. And now we can look at the effects of those two boxes of particles I showed you earlier, where in green are the particles that were at the top left, and their original trajectories are shown the original trajectory, so no smoothing. Basically saying particles are allowed to have Brownian motion. If we apply some penalty, then we force that trajectory to be smoother. If we apply an extreme penalty, we force that trajectory to be a straight line. Similar at the bottom right corner of the image, green is the original trajectory with all the noise or possibly Brownian motion. Black is with some smoothing imposed, and red is forced to be a straight line. Now we know something else about images, and this is observational. We know that particles that are near to each other appear to have similar trajectories, and we can benefit from enforcing that. So we can say that this particle over here is probably going to move similarly to the nearby particles. So we can replace its trajectory with a weighted average of the nearby trajectory. So the trajectory over here will be replaced by the sum of all the trajectories of the particles weighted by how far away the particles are. So the new trajectory is the sum of the trajectories of all the particles with this weighting factor, and the weighting factor depends on the distance d of all the particles contributing to that sum divided by exponential, where we're using some user-tunable parameter to say how strongly are we going to enforce this assumption that there's local correlation. Just looking at local correlation with no smoothing, green shows you the original trajectories. You apply some local smoothing, so sigma equals 500, and you see that you get smoother trajectories. The same is true as you move from green to black over here. And if you apply an extreme amount of local correlation, you force things that were at the top left of the image to have trajectories that are almost exactly the same as things that are at the bottom right of the image. You basically turn this into a whole frame alignment algorithm. So we don't want to use either of those smoothing approaches to an extreme. We want to allow particles to change trajectory. We want to allow local or global variation through the image. So if we apply a combination of those two with the user set parameters tuned down, we can get particle trajectories that are nice and smooth, they're locally correlated, but they're still global variation. So just to compare the different ways that you can smooth, or you can determine motion, there's this very elegant motion core algorithm. What you're doing there is you're taking a noisy movie frame and calculating the cross-correlation against another noisy movie frame, but it's nice and smooth because the problem is fabulously overdetermined. You could, in principle, also fit a trajectory and smooth that. So an advantage is the overdeterminedness of the problem. The disadvantage is you're comparing noisy images to noisy images. And it's for that reason that I don't think EFON goes below around 2,000 pixels by 2,000 pixels in the cross-correlation. There's Shorge's rely on particle polishing. And there what you're doing is, and Shorge will talk about this in greater detail, I hope, and you will, I asked. You're taking projections of the map and using those to align the particles. In order to smooth, you have this linear fitting, so you fit a straight line to the particle trajectories, and a rolling average of frames to increase the signal-to-noise ratio. One of the advantages is you're comparing noisy images, noisy image frames, to map projections. Map projections are extremely high signal-to-noise. The disadvantage is if you don't have the right map projection, or if your particle has a bit of ice contamination, if it doesn't match the map projection, or if it's in a different conformation, then that's going to interfere with your ability to align your particles. You could also imagine a simplified version, what I'll call a non-global iterative alignment, where you compare noisy particles to the sum of particles. So you take your noisy particles, and I think many of us have started our approaches to aligning particles by trying something like this. You take a noisy particle, you add them up, you align the particle to that reference, you add those up, you align the particle to the reference. You could smooth it by fitting a trajectory and making it a smooth trajectory. You could enforce local correlation. You're looking at the correlation between a noisy image and the sum of images, which has higher signal-to-noise but not as high signal-to-noise as a map projection. But it's much harder to build in the regularization we have with our objective function by saying we know this is smooth. So then we have our global optimization approach, where we're again comparing noisy images to the sums of noisy images, sort of better signal to noise. Our smoothing comes from penalizing changes in trajectory and enforcing local correlation. The advantage is that we can have these nonlinear trajectories and inherently regularized trajectories, inherently smooth when we search our objective function. The disadvantage is that compared to particle polishing, the sum of the images will never be as high signal to noise as the projection of the map. This should get better as you go to bigger and bigger particles, because the signal to noise ratio and the sum of the images should get better and better. So that it'll behave differently with particle size also. So let's put it all together. And this is, I'm going to show you a structure by Michael Latham, who's actually a postdoctoral fellow at Lucis K Lab. He's got a position in Texas, and in the last few weeks in the lab, he's been in our lab for quite a long time doing biochemistry. In the last few weeks, he decided to try cryo-EM. So it was his first experience with cryo-EM. He worked with my microscope manager, Samir Benlikber. And Lewis has done a lot of NMR spectroscopy on the 20S proteasome. So Mike took some 20S proteasome where he thought he had bound a protein, and it turns out it wasn't there. One grid, frozen in the virtual, they froze a few grids, they got one of them into the microscope. So this is an F20 at 200 kV with a side entry cryo holder. We use a 30 micron C2 aperture to get parallel illumination, a Gatan K2 summit in super resolution mode. We capture our movies at 5 electrons per pixel per second, corresponding to a 1.45 angstrom pixel, 30 frame movies for 15 seconds. We're doing these long exposures because we, just from the beginning, we've decided we want to try to limit the coincidence loss, where during the counting cycle, 2 electrons hit during one count, so you miss one of them. So we're doing long movies, 1 electron per angstrom squared per frame. They did one afternoon in the microscope, got 60 movies in super resolution. They downsampled them using Fourier truncation, using Alexey's program. Corrected the local movement with aligned parts LMB-FGS. Exposure weighting was applied in aligned parts LMB-FGS. We're just playing around with that now. We corrected magnification anisotropy for the particle images themselves, and the CTF parameters determined with CTF find, and had about 14,000 particles. And then after a couple of weeks of playing with RelyOn, we have this map of the proteasome at 3.8 angstroms resolution. Certainly one could do better, but I think that this demonstrates from the small particle population, you can quite nicely see beta strands, you see the pitch of helices, I think you can see some bulky side chains. We probably should return to this and do better, but just to make an apples to oranges comparison with the other proteasome structures out there, so there's Ifan's proteasome structure from 2013. It looks like Ifan's proteasome has also been running marathons. It seems to be a bit narrower than the others. There's Melanie Campbell's proteasome from a slightly larger data set at 4.2 angstroms resolution. That was done with RelyOn with particle polishing. I suspect that with optimization of their imaging and collecting more data, they could probably get close to the 3.3 angstroms of EFAN structure done with Freeline and just motion core, so no local alignment. So these are really quite different analyses. And then our own map calculated from 14,000 particles to 3.8 with RelyOn with LMB-FGS for particle local motion correction. So 300 kV microscopes are good. They'll have better direct detector response. They'll have a less curvature of the Ewald sphere, fewer multiple scattering events, less charging effects. With a more parallel beam, you might get some benefit. But probably, if we're getting 3.8 angstroms fairly easily, then I don't think that that's a limitation for most of our structures right now. We could use improved detectors. There still is room to go for getting a higher detector quantum efficiency. We almost certainly could use better algorithms for conformational separation. The 2D classification in RelyOn is orders of magnitude better than 2D classification that we were using 15 years ago. I suspect that over time, 3D classification will also improve a similar amount. We could do with improved spatial coherence of the microscope. We don't have the perfect FEG. We probably can do better with particle motion correction, and certainly improving specimen preparation to prevent particle motion can benefit us. With the state of instruments we have now, I think we should be able to get atomic resolution structures for structurally homogeneous things like the proteasome. Sub-nanometer resolution should become easier for heterogeneous things, and just as importantly, there'll be fewer blobs and fewer completely incorrect structures. I'd like to thank a few of the people whose work I showed you. So the Samir Benlikber is my microscope manager. Mike Latham from the K-Lab did the proteasome work. Jinhua Zhao worked on the magnification anisotropy, noticed the problem, and wrote a part of the programs to fix it. I mentioned Lindsay Baker's work on exposure weighting, and I refer, of course, to Tim and Lexi and Nico's work, and Ifan for being generous and putting his data set online, which has been very useful for many reasons. And I'd like to thank you for your listening.
Thanks very much, John. That was really, really super. Excellent. Tough audience, too.
Hey, did you try turning on and off your local and global smoothing to see if that has any effect on the resolution of your reconstruction?
No, and actually, so one of the reasons is that the computation with Reliant is very expensive. So what we're doing is we've made a little program that will extract the optimum values from Reliant so we can easily test the effects of all the different things we're trying. So because changing these parameters could mean that you have to re-refine your data. And actually, then we're going to have to rerun the refinement anyway. But the first thing we want to try is just a simple system for recalculating maps when we do or don't do exposure weighting, when we do or don't do smoothing, when we do or don't do local correlation.
Here. Yeah, a couple of things that comments or since I tried to remember the early. So the first thing that you mentioned about this the K2, the DQE, and then at high frequency, this counting and the super resolution, and that's exactly also the reason that we always record an image with a super resolution, with yeah. K2, and then you do the binning by yourself, and then you can get it. Then you get away with exactly this problem you described. Then you get a better DQE and better results.
Yes.
And then for this new per particle alignment, how low signal-noise ratio can you go? How noisy can the image go? So that's one of the...
We don't know, but the way that we pick particles in the lab now... Okay, so let me quickly flash up. This is not ideal, but you look at all these trajectories over here. See that, maybe you can see those trajectories. That came from an image that only had...
Hold on. Sergeant, can you bring the house lights down? I don't know if you can hear me.
Okay. So the image has far fewer particles than we're tracking. And it turns out we can take images. And probably Dan Shep's poster. Sorry, Dan Shep and Anna Zhao, I showed their faces. They have posters here where we've used this LMBFGS. Anna's poster is probably ideal for seeing this. We just pick a fixed number of particles or image and do template matching to choose particles and then let Reliant sort out which are the real particles and which are the junk. And you can see very reasonable trajectories for things that template matching has chosen. They're clearly not particles and are also extremely small. And by having things that aren't particles contribute to this local alignment, we benefit by having improved local correlation. There are more things to throw in local correlation. So we don't know how small you can go. Shores has actually tested it with the beta-galactosidase, but that was on a Falcon camera. So the Falcon camera will have lower... Okay. In fact, if you don't mind, I can show the trajectory. I have that. Okay. I meant to ask you and didn't get to it. So, and Shores clearly struggles to find particles in his images. So it seems to... I mean, we don't really know whether this is reality. For the trajectories, but it seems to find small things. And because it's on a Falcon, and our program will benefit from a better signal to noise in the sum, the low resolution DQE will be worse, and probably a beta-galactosidase in a Falcon would work, on a K2 might work better.
I think actually no. The upper left corner is carbon with lots of falsely positively picked beta-gal particles, but they were all going in. So the program gave good tracks, and then the reconstruction was very good.
It was reasonable, although I think you did see higher resolution by a few hundredths of an angstrom.
Then related to this one, that if you do the global motion correction first, then you may end up actually do have this fluctuation.
Have the fluctuation, exactly. So we always apply, Joaquin and I have discussed this, we always apply the local particle alignment without the global alignment. So we align globally. Right now, we're just using a whole frame version of this algorithm because it's a bit faster and we haven't got GPUs yet. We align globally, average, calculate CTFs, pick the particles, and then locally align the locally aligned particles from the unaligned stack so that we assume there's we're just seeing the physical motion of the particles.
So one more iteration on that question, John, here.
Here. Cool. Thank you. Hi.
Yeah, actually, so you say that the order you apply the correction is you first smooth the particle motion and then you look at the local neighborhood. I'm just thinking about this, and you probably thought about this much more, but is the function, you can permute the function, or if you did actually consider the jerky movements of the local neighborhood first and then smooth,
yes,
will be
so
better.
My advisor Marcus Brubaker also made that suggestion. We throw the penalty function into the optimization for an individual particle, and something that surprised both him and me is the bigger you make the penalty, the slower convergence is, probably because the function may be becoming less convex in optimization terms. So by adding a penalty function, it takes longer to converge. You could throw everything into the optimization. It might make things better. I suspect it will make things significantly slower. So right now it takes a couple of seconds per particle. It might be the right thing to do, because if we had a particle that tracked the trajectories, goes exactly the wrong way, we get it wrong, that's going to mess up the local alignment, local enforcement of correlation. It hasn't seemed to be a problem yet, but that would be a better algorithm and a more expensive algorithm. And a pain to figure out the derivative of that function.
Yes, it's Paul Penzeg again. I enjoyed the presentation immensely, as you can guess from my questions. But I'm afraid I'm losing the big picture. You refer to the method as a global optimizer. Is just a name, or it's a
family of techniques called global optimization.
Yeah, so this is where you lose me, because it appears you use gradient methods, Newton or limited memory. These are local optimizers, as far as I understand. So
with gradients, sorry.
Yeah. These are all. The approximation is that the goal function is quadratic. Yes, but the picture that you drew there had multiple local minima. Gradient method will not get you to a global minimum. So,
well, yeah, it's. I don't know that that's completely true.
It is completely true.
So it's not guaranteed global not guaranteed convergence. You never have a guarantee of convergence, but you generally will get convergence in a function that's pretty much convex. Global optimization in the sense that you're optimizing all the parameters. So I think it's semantic.
Well, normally when you say global optimization means that the method guarantees reaching global.
The only thing I've ever seen guaranteed was a method that you had certified as Paul Penzeg guaranteed.
No,
guarantees
myself. Just trying to figure the the nomenclature that you use, and it's possible that we disagree on.
All right, I think everybody probably wants to take a little break and get coffee or whatever. So we'll come back in what? I wasn't looking at the. Yeah.
Don't worry, there'll be a bell. That was great. Wow.
Good. I'm glad. I hope it was.